yeah, I'm currently sitting in an aircraft dripping wet and it won't start, and I'm floating downriver towards a 96 meter waterfall, which was about 300 meters downriver.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 4 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. It's great to have you all back on board for another episode, folks. Loving the feedback you guys are giving me as well. Keep it coming, please. It's great to hear that you guys are loving all of the episodes. You know, us floaties, we're a small group, so sharing your stories around the world inspires me to keep it up, and I know it's inspiring non-float rated pilots to get their feet wet at some stage in the future. However, I have a request for you all. To help On The Step grow, you can do your job by sharing it to your friends, not just on social media, but by telling them face to face or by sharing the episodes you love directly. Also, please leave a 5-star review. So far, only 2% of listeners actually leave a review. That is crazy. Come on, guys, get out there, leave a 5-star review. You know, tell the world about On The Step, and we'll all be rewarded with better and better content as the show grows. On to episode number 4, where we have another one of my work colleagues currently flying the Grumman Mallard. Michael Bostock didn't take, well, what most would consider the normal route to becoming a float pilot. But hard work and taking a leap of faith has seen him fly floats in Canada, and now he operates in a multi-crew role as a first officer on the Mallard. But first, folks, since the last episode, the batteries have been recharged. The globe has been replaced. It's time for our favourite segment, the Seaplane Spotlight. Okay, folks, so those of you who don't know, the Seaplane Spotlight shines the light on a seaplane operator anywhere around the world. Now, to be featured for a free shout-out of your business, send me a message on my Instagram or shoot me an email on thatmallardguy@hotmail.com. Okay, so today's Seaplane Spotlight comes all the way from San Francisco. It's a company called Seaplane Adventures. And actually, I've been on this aircraft over in San Francisco on one of their tours. It was absolutely fantastic, so I highly recommend them. They've got in touch through Instagram, so I'm going to go through their little questionnaire. So first of all, what seaplanes do you operate? They have De Havilland Beavers, DHC-2s. How many seaplanes do you have? They have 3. What is their main type of operation? Air tours and charter. So the tour I did, for example, was over the Golden Gate Bridge, down along the surf coast there, over the city of San Francisco, and it was absolutely epic. Highly recommend their tours. How many pilots do you employ? 5. What are your minimum hour requirements for new pilots? Minimum of 1,000 hours seaplanes and 500 hours in the Beaver. Do you offer seaplane training such as floatplane endorsements? We do offer training in the Beaver. We have 1 dual control, so obviously the other ones are single control Beavers. And if you've never flown a Beaver before, they have the Y-shaped column, so coming from the floor up to the pilot's laps, basically. And most of the Beavers are single control Beavers, so that is very cool. Once again, I'd love to recommend them. They are an awesome operator in San Francisco. Their website is a very easy one to remember, www.seaplane.com. And phone number 1-888-SEAPLANE. And like I said, to get involved next week on Seaplane Spotlight, get in contact and I'll tell the world all about your company. Okay, folks, the time has now come. Let's make a water taxi SeaTaf radio call. Check our hatches and harnesses are secure because it's time to get going on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Welcome, Michael Bostock, to the show. How are you, mate?
Good, Dan. Yourself?
Very, very good, mate. I must admit, I'm a little bit surprised that you agreed to come on this show. At the moment, with the coronavirus, you and I have been paired together. as a flight crew. So all the flying you're doing at the moment is with me. So I'm surprised that you actually want to do an interview with me outside of work hours. But thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Look, I mean, it could be worse. Let's put it that way.
I know a few of those other captains. So, mate, let's start it off with a little bit of a history of your interest in aviation. Where did you start off flying? And were seaplanes on the radar straight away, or did you just get into aviation for a love of flying to begin with?
So I started flying just after my 15th birthday. My interest was probably piqued mainly because my grandfather was a pilot in both the First and Second World Wars. And, yeah, just hearing all the stories from Dad and other relatives about his sort of time as a pilot really got me going in sort of the world of aviation. I think from what my parents have told me, I sort of went from the old fireman, policeman phase straight into pilot, and that sort of stuck with me all the way through schooling and uni and everything. So yeah, like my original plan was to join the Australian Air Force, much like him, and I got all the way through to the flight screening process where you go to Tamworth and do about 10 hours of flying or so there, and they assess you and potentially offer you a position as a pilot in the Defence Force. And got through all that, but I had my heart set on fast jets and they only wanted to give me helicopters. And at the time I was like, nah, I think I'll try something else. And yeah, ended up going to Swinburne to do the aviation course there, and got a commercial pilot's license out of that.
That's really cool. So how long was the Swinburne course that you did, and was the CPL included in that course?
Yeah, so the course was like a full comprehensive aviation bachelor degree, and then concurrently with that you did a commercial pilot's license and instrument rating as part of like an integrated course over those 3 years. Previously to that, I'd started a little bit of flying. Like I said, had my first lesson on my 15th birthday out of Geelong Airport, or the old Geelong Airport, I should say. It's no longer there anymore, unfortunately. And sort of got up through to my restricted license, or GFPT as it used to be called. But yeah, the course itself at Swinburne was 3 years, and yeah, got your CPL and instrument rating, night rating, all that sort of stuff out of it.
So did you come out with it? Was it like a Bachelor of Aviation or something, was it?
Yeah, Bachelor of Aviation and Graduate Certificate in Aviation Piloting.
I know that I actually flew down Geelong as well. We've spoken about that before, but we didn't actually know each other at the time, which was pretty funny, and now we're both ending up flying the Mallard, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
How did you feel that, like, for example, I did the normal commercial aviation 150-hour course at Geelong Aviation Flight Training. How did you find the uni degree compared to some people you may have met in your career who did that? Did you feel like it gave you a bit of an advantage or a bit of a leg up in front of other people?
There's pros and cons to everything, I think. But on the positive side, there was a big group of people. I think we had first year, we started with about 120 people. By the end of the 3 years, we were down to about 80 people in the course, all going through the flying, all going through the exact same thing as you. So you had, you know, a good opportunity to meet people, make friends. You know, a lot of the guys I went to uni with, I'm still friends with to this day. So yeah, and the other thing was that you were able to access government fee help, which was basically the government giving you a tax-free loan to put towards flight training.
Yeah, I guess and one of those things you mentioned there with meeting people would have gave you a lot of contacts down the track, wouldn't it? In all branches of aviation, whether it be float planes like you're in now or seaplanes, but also maybe the airlines or other random aspects of aviation. So that would have been a positive.
Yeah, definitely. Like I've got, I know people that are flying for Qantas, Virgin, Jetstar, flying geomagnetic survey, ferry pilots, ag pilots, fire bombers, you know, the list just goes on and on. it's amazing when you think about it, how wide and how diverse the aviation industry is and what it allows you to do.
Exactly. And I can imagine that you sitting in that classroom back then, who would have thought you'd be flying a 70-year-old aircraft?
Not me.
Exactly. Sure. And I imagine a lot of people in the class wouldn't be believing it either. So that's one of the great things about aviation. And you mentioned it there as well with the university, the fee help. We all know as pilots, aviation training is very expensive. So those options in the industry now for fee help, albeit vet fee or loans, etc., that can be a real decisive point when choosing which path to go down for your aviation training.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, I would always been a pilot, and you know, I would have got there eventually. It's just that for me, this was the most direct path. It meant that I could go and do all of my training all at once in a condensed period of time. Granted, at a much higher cost. You know, I was learning to fly with Oxford Aviation at the time, and their prices were probably amongst the most expensive in the country. But that's sort of the price you pay for having that government loan available to you at the time.
So was that an option, which training provider you went through for the actual flying component, or was that teed in with the university?
Yeah, it was all tied in with the university. So the year that I started uni was the first year that they'd actually offered flight training and the government loan together, and Oxford and Swinburne were one of the first. They were the only ones in Victoria. There was also Griffith University in Queensland, and flight training Adelaide in South Australia that also offered it. But being a Melbourne boy, I figured I'd stick with something local.
Yeah, fair enough. Now, with the seaplane aspect of it, when you were back there in your training, I know being down from in Melbourne, Geelong area, that the surf coast is a really popular spot. So a lot of people they love the water. Were seaplanes very much on your horizon at that stage, or was that something that grew in later at your training?
Initially, not so much. I mean, I knew that there was a seaplane at Geelong on the bay there, and you know, my grandmother had a house in Torquay actually, so we'd go down there quite often and quite often see the seaplane flying around, whatever. But yeah, not really until probably second year of uni when someone introduced me to Trans-Maldivian Airways. And showed me some photos of their operation and, you know, the pristine white beaches and, you know, vivid blue waters of the Maldives, and, you know, guys flying twin otters on floats with no shoes on. And it's just, I was like, wow, this looks amazing. And that sort of really kickstarted the whole interest and almost obsession with float flying. But then on the flip side of that, I started doing a bit of research and looking into how I might potentially get a job there. And initially I was a bit disheartened because in Australia there just wasn't that many training options available. What there was very expensive. So, yeah, it sort of fell to the back burner.
Yeah, right. And I also looked a lot into the Maldives and found it to be a very attractive-looking operation to go work for. Like you said, with the white beaches and the beautiful turquoise waters. And that was when I was currently flying seaplanes in the Whitsundays, which were very much the similar location.
Pretty much just the Australian equivalent,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, probably. I guess it would be. And I was lucky enough to go over there with my girlfriend at the time, now wife, on a holiday because we wanted to look into it. And the flying was insane, you know, flying out to a resort that we stayed at. Doing four water stops and getting dropped off, and then coming home with like a fully loaded twin otter bags almost coming out the windows. It looked so heavily loaded it looked, but it just jumped off the water. So leaving Swinburne, and where did you end up getting your first job, and how did you find getting that first job coming out of training in the aviation industry?
Yeah, so I have a first job, obviously, but my first job I don't classify as my first job. I was a hired as a contract whale shark spotter for a company in Exmouth. They had a 172 and a 152 that they used throughout their whale shark swimming season. And, yeah, got the opportunity to go and fly for them. Initially, it was going to be a six-week contract, but I only worked for them for about 9 days because on the 10th day, they said, oh, we've got another pilot that is available to do the flight today. If you'd like to come onto the boat, we'll let you have a swim with the whale sharks. I said, absolutely, would love to do it. And ended up by the end of the day with perforated eardrum and ear infection, which took me out for the rest of 6 weeks. So that was technically my first job, but my real first job, as I consider it, was as a flight instructor. I moved to Ballarat in sort of central Western Victoria. And flew for a company called ST Aerospace there for about 3 years, training mainly Chinese airline cadets, but also Singaporean and Qatar Airway cadets as well.
Yeah, cool. And just going back to that, the actual first job that you mentioned there, it must have been really hard, like getting your break in the aviation industry and then only 9 days in having to give up your spot because of an illness, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really annoyed at myself because it was sort of mainly down to my own stupidity that I perforated the eardrum just trying to follow a whale shark down as it started to dive. And yeah, so, but in that 9 days, it was a huge learning experience. You know, probably a third or fourth day in, had some low cloud and, you know, got myself into a situation that I really shouldn't have. And even in that short period of time that I worked for them, it gave me a bit of an appreciation of when to say no and how to go about saying no.
And that's a hugely important thing to take into it to the start of your GA career, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the number of stories of guys getting themselves into bad situations and most of them getting themselves out okay. But you know, there's always that few that don't quite make it out. So yeah, learning that lesson really early on and getting out the other side was a hugely important lesson for me.
I've actually got a whale shark story as well, mate. It's not as bad as yours perforating your eardrum, but when I was in the Maldives, back to that story as well, we went whale shark hunting and we were sitting on this boat. We were out for about 3 hours, I think, and there was no whale shark to be spotted. And they get you to be all dressed up, basically, with your mask and your snorkel. And he sits up on the top. And as soon as they see one, they bang on the roof and you just basically run and jump in the water. And I was in such a panic rush at the end of this trip because we gave up, basically. We didn't think we were going to see one. And I jumped in the water and first thing I realized straight away is that my snorkel had actually come off. So I was... ended up duck diving without a snorkel to try and spot this whale shark. So there's something about whale sharks by the sound of it with pilots and whale sharks. Just maybe they should just give up, I think.
Yeah, marine creatures in general, I think, just they need to be well separated.
So going on to your instructing job, how did you find that you claim as your first job now in the aviation industry?
Scary. In a word, scary. Some of the experiences that I had there with the Chinese, they would make your blood boil, really. A lot of it down to lack of understanding and sort of poor communication in the cockpit between student and instructor, whether that was mainly down to the student or the instructor, time will tell. But, yeah, like it was great experience, you know, great guys. It was big company. You know, I think at one stage we had about 45 instructors and, you know, 15 or 20 support staff. So, yeah, really good company to work for and as many hours as you could possibly want. Anything from, you know, I did everything from initial training, like, you know, first lesson to circuits, sending guys solo, did spin training, IFR training, didn't get into the twins while I was there, but, you know, there was plenty of that. There was King Air work. So as a first job with the aim to build ours, it was exceptional. It was really good. But at the same time, the motivation of some of the students at times felt like it was lacking. And it was mainly, I think, down to the fact that it wasn't coming out of their back pocket. The cost of training wasn't coming out of their back pocket. Some of the guys you talked to, they'd had careers previously. We had, you know, radiologists, doctors, nurses, and they'd come over to Australia to become an airline pilot because it was considered to be more prestigious and a better job for them and their family back in China.
I didn't realise that the age of some of the candidates there were probably a bit older. Yeah. And I thought they were all a lot of, you know, 19, 20-year-olds coming straight out from China or overseas straight into learning to fly. So that's quite interesting to hear that they were a little bit older as well. And you spoke about before, you know, that the relationship in the cockpit. I could imagine that instructing just in general is hard to get a point of view across, let alone having some sort of language barrier to overcome.
Yeah, and that was the big thing. It was the language barrier. It was the anywhere from 1 to 5 second delay between giving them an instruction and then them actually carrying it out. So, you know, sometimes you'd be like, okay, you need to add power, and then add power, and you just go tick, 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 and the guy would go, oh, that's what he wants me to do. Oh, and he'd do it, and it'd be perfect, but it'd just be 3 seconds late.
Yeah.
So you almost become a bit of a psychic in saying, okay, I know that this is going to happen in the next few seconds, so I'm just going to tell him to do it early.
Yeah, I could imagine you'd get used to reading how they flew in the end.
And, yeah, very much.
Yeah, I know myself flying in, doing a bit of flying in Vietnam with some Vietnamese co-pilots, not an instructional role, more of a multi-crew role, but I definitely understand what that, how that language barrier can affect flying an airplane. And, you know, I found probably the worst thing was is that they didn't really question if they didn't understand.
Yeah, absolutely. The worst phrase you ever wanted to hear out of them was "yes, sir," because you knew that they had absolutely no idea what you were talking about.
So you said you were there for 3 years, were you? Just doing all ab initio type flying, was it?
Yeah, ab initio, CPL, all the way up to single engine IFR training by the end. And, you know, as they got more experience, they got better and better, which you'd hope. So, yeah, did that for about 3 years, and then before I moved over to Pass Bailey, I'd gone to a few other places and done some instructing there. I worked at the North Queensland Aero Club out of Mareeba for about 2 months just while they were busy, and STAA in Ballarat was fairly quiet. And the difference that I saw between the students between the two places was phenomenal. You know, I had a guy on his very first lesson that I did the takeoff and he did everything else. He even landed the aircraft first lesson, and I sort of sat next to him and said, you've basically done a better landing than I've done all week. And he's like, yeah, no, I'm just a heavy machine operator. And, you know, his brain's the sort that, once he understands how control works and how it moves the machine around, he can put it all together. And
my old man used to say to me that crane drivers make really good helicopter pilots.
Yep.
So during this instructional period, that 3 years you did it in Ballarat, and when you were moving around instructing jobs, did you have seaplanes on the radar, or were you following a lot of everyone else's goal of probably trying to get into the airlines?
Yeah, so initially it was sort of get the hours, get the experience, you know, get on twins, all that sort of stuff. And it wasn't really until I was actually in Japan on a holiday with a mate, and we were walking around Osaka of all places, and the topic came up of what would you want to do if you could do anything? And I sort of said, oh, I'd love to fly float planes. I'd love to give it a go. And we kept chatting, and I basically came to the conclusion that by the end of that year, I was going to have at least once flown a float plane and hopefully had a float rating by the end of that.
Did you achieve that goal in that year? Or?
Yeah, so I'd looked at it in the past, sort of the previous 2 or 3 years, but it always just sort of been like, oh, it might be nice, but oh, it's too much money, or it's too hard, too much time. But yeah, in 2016, sort of got myself in gear and headed over to Canada, a place called Kelowna in British Columbia, and worked with a company there, Earhart, that had a really good reputation online, and a couple of people that I'd met online and sort of spoken to said, yeah, these guys are really good. They were really helpful. And it was at a time when the exchange rate between Aussie and Canadian dollars was really good. It was 1-to-1, if not better.
And I imagine the flying over there was probably a bit cheaper as well, was it?
Yeah, much cheaper, much cheaper. So I did about 40 hours over there, and it cost me
all
just...
All float plane, was it?
All float plane, all Cessna 180 float plane, just straight floats, so no amphibian stuff. And that all up cost me just a little bit more than what a 7 or 10 hour endorsement in a Beaver would have cost in Australia.
And you get the cool experience of going over to Canada and living over there for a little bit as well.
Yeah, so it was basically a holiday. I did 40 hours, got a Canadian CPL while I was over there, and yeah, flew through sort of central BC through the Rocky Mountains, you know, flying into mountain lakes at 2,500 feet, and you know, flying through canyons and all this sort of stuff. It was absolutely unreal experience. That's what really cemented my love of flying floats.
I could only imagine.
Yeah, got back and I was just like, yeah, got to do it.
That's great. And it must have been pretty hard as well, because like I know that going through like something like the Ballarat instructing job that you had, where you're surrounded by 40 guys who probably all want to go the one direction, and that's into the airline. So to potentially go against that trend and then go overseas to another country to go and just be able to tick off that float rating, that must have been a pretty big experience in your life at that time.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I got back and a couple of the guys were like, oh, you're back. I'm like, yeah, I said I'd be back, you know, 2 months later, 3 months later, whatever. And they're like, oh, yeah, we thought you were joking. We thought you were leaving and you had a job somewhere else in Australia. I'm like, no, it was legit. I was going over to Canada, do my float rating, whatever, have a blast, and, yeah, come back and try and save some money so that I could get back over there again at some point.
So when was the step from getting that float rating and really getting the bug, I guess, to gaining that first actual seaplane flying job? And it's pretty funny, like in aviation, you got to go chase that first job, but now you're actually going out and basically doing it again to try and get your first seaplane job.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I first went over to Kelowna and started the training there, in my mind, it was just like, this is a really good way to burn some cash, have some fun. And talking to the guys there, they're like, oh, have you considered coming over here and making it a career? And I was like, oh, not really. Like, I'm not a Canadian citizen. And they're like, oh, it doesn't matter. Aussies can get work visas really easily because 95% of the people that work on the ski mountains in Canada are Aussies anyway. So you're just taking a slightly different career path. So yeah, looked into that, started applying to every float operator in Canada under the sun, of which there's something like 230 odd float operators.
And compared to Australia, that is ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in Australia, there's probably a dozen. And I think that's being fairly generous, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So, yeah, like, and, you know, you've got places like Harbour Air, you've got Kenmore, you've got Ken Borick. There's all these massive operators that have, you know, fleets of anywhere from 5 to 15 float planes. And, you know, I think Harbour Air has 30-odd planes and 50 pilots or something. It's huge.
Yeah, it's a mini airline really, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I applied for all of them. Didn't really hear much back, but I did get my work visa approved in the period while I was waiting to hear back. and then got a call from my old instructor in Kelowna, and he said, oh, I've got a friend and someone who used to be a student of mine that's looking for a pilot. The job's in Fort Simpson. I said, oh, cool, sounds great. And as I did that, jumped on Google Maps and had a quick search of where Fort Simpson was. For those of you that don't know where it is, it's about 62 degrees north in terms of latitude, and about 400 k's to the west of Yellowknife as the crow flies on the Mackenzie River. So it's way up there. It's proper ice pilot's country. And to put it into perspective, a similar sort of latitude in the southern hemisphere is about 2,000 k's closer to the pole than the southern tip of Tasmania.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, so had a chat with the senior pilot at Simpson Air and did a phone interview on the couch drinking coffee in my PJs, which is...
Luckily, the video chat wasn't enabled then.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, most relaxed interview I think I've ever done. So that was great. And then, yeah, you know, went through all the bits and bobs, and he said at the end of the call, all right, if you want the job, be in Fort Simpson on May the 1st. I was like, wow, that was easy.
And I imagine doing that interview in the pajamas, mate. Was there any times over in Canada in Fort Simpson where you probably could have been wearing your pajamas because of the time that you would have been flying?
Oh, absolutely. I was so in Fort Simpson in the summertime, there was no nighttime in terms of aviation. Like, you know, it was all daylight flying, 24 hours a day.
So you'd be hating life if you were trying to get some night hours, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. But then all you had to do is wait 6 months, and you only had about 4 hours of daylight, so it was all good.
Yeah, crazy.
But yeah, I remember on my birthday actually flying back into town at 11 o'clock at night, going, oh, I've just done, I think it was about 10 and a half hours of flying, and it's 11 o'clock at night. I'm absolutely exhausted, and I've got nothing to eat. I've got no food. And just as I land, my phone goes off, and the guys are like, oh, come by the inn. We've ordered some food for you. Happy birthday.
Happy days.
This is great.
I thought you were going to say that they called you up and said, you got another flight to do because there's no midnight.
No, I would have quite quickly told him to
get stuffed.
Yeah, get stuffed.
So what was the flying that you were doing out at Fort Simpson there?
Yeah, so Fort Simpson started off for about a month on wheels on the 206, just sort of get myself comfortable with the operation. The float season still hadn't started. The Mackenzie River, where we operated from, was still frozen when I arrived. So, yeah, spent about a month on wheels, and then after that, float season started, and started flying the Cessna 185 on straight floats. And the main work that we were doing was scenic flights through the national park, the Nahanni National Park, which encompasses the South Nahanni River and a couple of key points like the Virginia Falls and Glacier Lake and the Ragged Range. So, yeah, we had a couple of different tours. One was about a 4.5-hour tour where you'd fly out to Virginia Falls. You'd land there just upstream of the falls, and the guests would spend about 2 hours sort of wandering around that area. They had Parks Canada had a spot there, and they would have a couple of interpreters that would take the guests along a boardwalk and talk to them about the history of the area, the local people, some of the local stories about the falls, and then you get to have a look at the falls, take photos and all that sort of stuff. And then a slightly longer tour, about 5.5 to 6 hours, where we continue further upriver to a place called Glacier Lake, which was just at the base of the Ragged Range, which was basically 6,000 to 8,000 foot mountains above the surface of the river. So I think all up, some of the higher peaks were up around the 9,000 to 10,000 feet mark. And yeah, just this like bright emerald turquoise lake at the base, and some of the most spectacular scenery you've ever seen. So yeah, we'd land there.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Oh, absolutely. And like there were glaciers up the back. There's a part of the Ragged Range was called the Cirque of the Unclimbables. And that's a really famous North American rock climb. I think it was in the 25 classic climbs of North America or something, of some book that some guy had written. And yeah, the scenery there was just spectacular. So we'd drop them there, spend, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes just wandering around there, maybe get a canoe out and have a little bit of a paddle on the lake, see if we could spot some wildlife, and then fly back to another lake that's just outside the park where Simpson Air owned a wilderness lodge called Little Doctor Lake and the Nahani Mountain Lodge. And again, just spend sort of 45 minutes there exploring that. And again, just amazing scenery. Like coming from Australia where everything's so flat, and then going over to Canada where there's, you know, an 8,000 foot mountain is like one of the small ones. You're like, this is crazy. You hardly ever see snow-capped mountains and everything, and you don't get the real fall color changes, and you know, there's no moose and all that sort of stuff. It's the little things for a Canadian or a North American, but for me, it was just breathtaking every single day.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's a fair difference to what we're flying in around here, where the highest aerodrome that we go in and out of is, I think, about 200 feet.
Yeah.
And that's actually right next to the ocean, so that's not very high at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's crazy. You're making me really jealous and make me really want to get over there and do some mountain seaplane flying. That'd be really cool.
Yeah. In the end, like, the fact that I did all that training around Kelowna where there are mountains and you get a bit of a perspective and a bit of understanding was absolutely invaluable. If I'd done, you know, a 7-10 hour course over here in Australia and then tried to get a job over there, it would have been a very, very different story.
Absolutely. I remember when I was doing some IFR flying up in Cairns, North Queensland there, one of the guys said that if you ever get into any trouble in cloud or you don't know where you are, basically, if you can climb, I think it was like something like 7,900 feet, you basically will miss everything in at least North Queensland, but it could even be Australia.
Yeah.
People don't realize how flat Australia is. I think the highest mountain, something like 8,000 feet or something like that. It's crazy the difference between flying over there or even places like New Zealand where there's such high mountains as well.
Absolutely.
I know from our conversations we've had in the cockpit, you had a crazy story down a river one day. Tell us all about that.
Yeah. So, all right, where to start? So, first of all, we are in the Cessna 185, which, before I continue, I must say I absolutely love. One of my favorite aircrafts to fly.
So I did my flight rating in that, actually, and it was good fun.
Oh, they're great fun. So, it was middle of the season. I had maybe 100 hours, 150 hours of float experience by this stage, starting to get in the groove of things. You know, it was just another standard day as far as I was concerned. The previous week, the other company had their Twin Otter have an engine malfunction. So that was now inoperative. And we picked up a whole stack of flying, and we were just trying to basically catch up. So been really busy. Flew out to the national park, landed at Virginia Falls and got the guests off the plane. There were two docks that we had there, and normally whoever was there first would take the front dock, second person would take the back dock, and if anyone else came, there was a very, very small beach, just maybe 50 metres upriver, where you could fit one more plane on. So, yeah, I'd always dealt with the docks, never looked at doing any beaching or anything. But on this particular occasion, I was actually the first one there, and it turned out that I was going to need to get the passengers off, move them, and then move the plane onto the beach, and park it there for a couple of hours while other planes came in and out. So spoke to the senior pilot, and we went through all the process and everything. I said, yep, cool, makes sense. I think I understand it all. And, yeah, managed to get the aircraft on the beach, tied up, no problems, happy days. Came back 2 hours later, plane's still there, yippee. And I said to the passengers, all right, you wait here by the dock, I'll bring the plane around, and then we'll load up and we'll go. And again, spoke to the senior pilot and said, you know, how should I do this? And we talked through the process, and I was fairly confident with it. It seemed like a fairly simple process, you know, get it all primed up, ready to go, untie it, push it off, give it a little bit of a swing so that as you fire up, you're not pointed back in at the bank. And happy days.
Oh, so you were nosed into the beach, were you?
Yeah, we were nosed into the beach. And the current on the river was about 8 or 9 knots at this time of year. So it was pretty quick.
Now, this current's due to the fact that it leads to a big waterfall, yeah?
Yeah, 96-metre waterfall.
And this is the waterfall that everyone came to fly over and have a look at as well?
Yes, same waterfall. So basically get it all primed up, ready to go. Untie it, push it off, go to give it a swing. And the first mistake that I made was I tried to take 3 steps on the float, and only 2 out of those 3 steps ended up on the actual float. So straight away, I'm in glacial melt water, freezing cold river, managed to get back up onto the float and into the aeroplane, went to turn the key, and nothing happened. Turned out that the battery had just been a little bit weak. It was coming up for a battery inspection in the next couple of hours, couple of days, and it would have failed quite easily. So, yeah, I'm currently sitting in an aircraft, dripping wet, and it won't start. And I'm floating downriver towards a 96-metre waterfall, which was about 300 metres downriver.
So not far away at all.
Not far away at all. Then the first thing I did was went, right, I've got to grab my paddle and start paddling. And this was the second time that I've ever paddled a float plane. And the first time was on a beautiful glassy day on a lake, just as a practice, just to understand the mechanics of it and have a go at it. This time it was windy. We were in a 8-knot, 9-knot current, floating slowly, or not so slowly, I should say, towards the 206, which was on the front dock, and then the another 185, which was behind it as well, getting ready to move. So I start paddling and manage to miss both the aircraft on the docks there, but now I'm in the middle of the river and I've got no way of getting the aircraft to go where I want it to go.
So initially you were actually starting to paddle to not bring the plane back to shore, but to avoid the other 2 planes on the dock. So you're kind of paddling out to the shore more. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was just paddling. I didn't know what I was doing, to be honest. I think I ended up doing about 2 or 3 full circles, full rotations while I was paddling there. And yeah, by the end of it, I was in the middle of the river and managed to get a rope, and one of the other pilots managed to run alongside the shore and tossed a rope to him, and by some miracle pulled the aircraft into the shore, and didn't do a single bit of damage to it whatsoever. Squeezed it in between 2 trees. So that by that stage, I was probably now 150 meters from the falls and probably about 50 meters from where I was going to bail out and just let the airplane go where it was going to go.
Yeah, that's crazy. That gets my heart racing, that story. And I imagine that icy water, like, that wouldn't have even been that easy to swim in either if you had to have bailed out.
No, I was, like, fully clothed. I wasn't even in, like, shorts and a T-shirt. It was jeans, heavy boots, T-shirt and hoodie. And, yeah, I was just like, this is not fun at all. And the whole time that this is going on, my passengers are standing on the dock saying, what's going on? Where's he going? What's happening? And not fully understanding what's happened.
No, like most passengers, they wouldn't have had any idea, would they?
Yeah. And then I had to try and convince them once they understood what had happened to get back in the plane and come home with me.
Yeah, right.
They weren't all that keen, I'll tell you that much.
So how did you fix the problem in the end?
So it just turned out to be, like I said, a weak battery. Just ended up finding the cylinder that had the least compression on it. And once the prop started to get a little bit of momentum going, it kept cranking through and managed to get it started. So, yeah, it was very lucky. Otherwise, we would have been stranded there until someone had been able to come out and rescue us.
Yeah, crazy. And some really cool GA experience along the way.
Yeah, some really cool GA experience I would rather not have.
I have a similar story actually at my first flying job. I was working with my old man down in Geelong there, and I went to launch the plane into the water in the morning, and I jump in the plane and I don't have the key. I'd left the key at the bench at dad's house when I went to go pick up all the gear to set up shop in the morning. And so I'm sitting there drifting as well with the wind towards Cunningham Pier in Geelong, which is this huge old wool pier. So it's got railway tracks and it's now got all these cars parked on and everything. And I'm slowly drifting towards that. And we had a spare key that was kept in the glove compartment. That wasn't there at the time. So it didn't get put back the last time it was used. So I started paddling as well and I called my old man up and he ended up racing down to bring the spare key down, and it was literally only about 10 metres away from actually hitting the pier as well. So I didn't have a 90 metre waterfall to fall down, but I probably would have lost my job for that one.
Probably would have been sleeping outside as well for the next week or so.
That's one thing people don't realise with seaplanes is if the engine doesn't start, it's doesn't have brakes. It doesn't just... you can't just jump out and go and tell the instructor or go and chat to the chief pilot and say the plane's broken. You've now got to stop your boat from drifting down wherever you are. So,
yeah.
So how long were you there in Canada all up at this place in Fort Simpson?
About 9 months all up. It was going to be longer, but about 4 months in, my girlfriend came over and we were looking at making a semi-permanent move over to Canada, and it just ended up being not right for us. She was there for about 2 weeks and had sort of 9 days planned off together, and of that I got about two. So yeah, that and a few other things, like, you know, Port Simpson was very small, so made the decision to look for a job back in Australia. And yeah, about 2 weeks after I started looking for a job, the job with Pass Bailey came up on the web of all places.
It's a funny one, the Pass job, because it doesn't come up very often. But then when it does, it's either jumped on by a lot of pilots or people have kind of got their own job somewhere else and they can't make the move. So
yeah,
how was that experience trying to get that job?
Well, I saw it and I was like reading through the ad and I'm like, oh yeah, I've got that many hours. I've got that many hours on floats. Hey, I've got that many water landings. I meet the minimum requirements for this job. This is insane. And sent off an email to Andrew, the chief pilot. And the first sentence of the reply was, well, applying for a job in Australia while you're in Canada does pose problems, doesn't it? My heart just sank. I was like, oh, no, this is not going to end well. And then I kept reading the email. He's like, when do you expect to be back in Australia. You know, we can potentially look at setting up an interview for you, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I think I waited for about 2 months until I got back to Australia, and then flew up to Darwin, did an interview with Andrew and yourself, actually. And, yeah, was lucky enough to be told that the job was mine once Pass Bailey had the training capacity to put me on.
Yeah, I remember that interview. I don't want to talk you up too much, but it was a really good interview. And I remember actually walking out of that interview with Andrew and Peter Klein, who was in the interview because of his experience in Canada, to ask a few Canada-specific questions. And I said to Andrew straight away, I said, oh, he's going to be the next pilot who flies a pass. Because it wasn't actually, you didn't actually get the job straight away. It wasn't like, we'll talk to you in a couple of days and you can start in 2 weeks, was it? It took a while, didn't it?
No, it was it was about 6 months or so between the interview and getting the job. So, yeah, it's funny you say that, because I walked out of that interview going, oh, I don't know that I've done too well in that. I felt very much under the pump. And then when Peter Klein started pulling out all his Canada experience, I'm like, yeah, and he was fairly kind to me. I think there are a few things there that I said wrong, and he didn't pull me up on them. He's just like, yeah, that's close enough. So yeah, about 6 months. But in that time, I was able to get my HPL theory subjects done, and I did some work for a guy that I'd met during my time at Ballarat, and ended up doing a bit of multi flying for him.
I know ATPL subjects are a big one for down the track for command rating and whatnot. So that would have been good to tick those off. And I think any Australian pilot, if they've got them hanging over their head, it causes a lot of stress. So it must have been great to tick those off.
Yeah, definitely. I was getting to my wit's end by the end of the second attempt of flight planning. I sort of said, walking into the exam to myself, if I don't pass it this time or come extremely close, I don't know what I'm going to do, because I've done absolutely everything I possibly can. And this exam it's not a practical exam in any way, shape or form. The training course that I did with AFT, the guy that ran the course basically said, the aim of this exam is not to get the right answer, it's to get the exam answer. And I was like, well, that doesn't make sense, but okay, whatever, skip past that. It's just one of those things that everyone's had to get through. Once I got through that, it was all downhill from there. So that was great.
You can't really say that flying a 727 is not practical, mate. It's a very relevant aircraft in our day and age, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be if we were able to use the flight planning software that they used when flying the 727.
That's probably another topic for many other shows I'm sure we could go deep into.
Oh, yeah.
So you've now got this job on the Mallard. Talk about moving up to Darwin, a very isolated capital city of Australia that it is compared to Melbourne, for example, and definitely a huge weather change.
Yeah.
And then starting your flying training on the Mallard.
Yeah. So once I'd sort of got the job and knew when my start date was and all that, packed up the car and drove, I think it's 4,500 Ks from Melbourne to Darwin, straight up through the centre of Australia, with nothing but me, myself, and me, audiobooks, podcasts, Spotify, all that sort of stuff. Very little Spotify.
It's a shame on the step with that Mallard guy wasn't around back then, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. I would have listened to it. got up to Darwin, got out of the car, and I just remember feeling that wave of heat and going, yeah, cool, we're in the tropics now. So yeah, then went through all the ground school with Andrew and started to learn all the systems. And for me, the Mallard was a huge step up. Previously, like, I had very limited twin experience, no turbine experience at all, no hull time, no floating hull time, and very limited float time compared to guys that Pass Bailey had hired in the past.
And probably no multi-crew time?
Yeah, no multi-crew time. The one I did have in my favour was IFR time. I had
Yeah, right.
Quite a bit of that. So I was fairly comfortable with that. But everything else was new. So yeah, got to Darwin, did all the ground training, and my first training flight in the Mallard with Duncan was I think day three of Pitch Black, which is a big military exercise that happens every couple of years in the Northern Territory, where there's countless numbers of nations that participate. It's got Australia, US, I think New Zealand, Singapore, a couple of other countries in there as well, and they all come in and fly their jets around, and for everyone else on the airport, make a general nuisance of themselves, but for themselves, I think they get some good quality training out of it. But yeah, I was in about day three, taxiing out, and we ended up sitting on the ground for over an hour waiting to take off. And that whole time I was sitting in the left-hand seat, feet on the brakes. Mallard doesn't have a park brake that we use. And Duncan neglected to inform me that the engines actually had beta and I could put them into beta to prevent the aircraft from rolling forward as we were on a bit of a downslope. So I spent about 45 minutes continuously just feet planted on the brakes. And by the end of that, I was pretty ready to go home, but I still have to actually do the first lesson. So
I love that story as well, because one of the things with the Mallard, especially with those engines, is it has a limited range that the propeller can actually be sitting in. So between generally at an idle, it's about 800, and it's limited to 1100 RPM because of the four blades. And so you would have actually had a little bit of forward thrust, or even more power on, just to keep it out of that 1100 to 800 range.
Yeah.
So that would have made things even worse.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So you talk about you're in the left seat there. So your current role at the moment is the first officer in the right-hand seat. So initially the training is to get the type rating ticked off?
Yeah, yeah. So you get the type rating ticked off from the left-hand seat. And because of the way the Mallard's set up, there's a few little idiosyncrasies between the left and the right seat, one of them being that only the left-hand seat has brakes. So all taxiing and all ground ops are done by the captain, except in that type rating. When you're going through, you do all the taxiing and everything, all the early parts of the takeoff as well.
And how did you find the Mallard on the water once you started doing the water training compared to all the float plane stuff that you'd done?
A handful. It's a great aircraft to fly, and it's got really good performance. Like, it gets off the water like nothing on that I've ever flown. But it has a very heavy porpoise tendency. So if you get trying to get onto the step and things get a little bit out of whack, it can get very, very untidy very quickly. And that was the thing that I struggled with the most. And really the only way to get past it is just more practice.
And that's something that unfortunately we don't get a lot of, do we, in our normal line flying, being the long flights that we do.
Yeah, especially with those long sectors. And, you know, you'll do 4 or 5 hours of flying in a day, but only one guy's gotten one water landing and one guy's got a water takeoff.
That's it. We're sharing the water work as well as a multi-crew. So
yeah,
that's definitely one thing that's a bit of a negative about flying the Mallard, isn't it? That the water work, say, for example, is what you're doing over in Canada, where you're probably doing sometimes 10, 15 water landings a day, I imagine.
Yeah,
sometimes definitely. You can only be doing one a week.
Yeah, exactly. But that is one of the best things about Pat's Bailey, is that they are fully aware of that. And, you know, just the other week I went to the chief pilot and I said, hey, haven't done a huge amount of water landings and water takeoffs in the last little bit. Did one the other day. It felt really untidy. Can we go out and just do a little bit of training at our water training area just outside Darwin? He's like, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a couple of days later we were out there and I think we did something like 23 water landings and takeoffs and, you know, all the weird and wonderful things that you probably only do once every couple of months, but when you do it, you need to know how to do it, like your glassy water landings and rough water landings and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, they're really good in that sense of being very open and willing to do that sort of top-up training and currency flying.
I would imagine that would have really built up your confidence again, going out there and doing so much water work.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
What other aspects of the mallard do you really love?
It's really just a big, simple, basic aircraft once you get past the fact that it's, you know, 6.3-ton takeoff weight and twin turbine IFR. It's just like a big Cessna. So we don't have autopilot. So all the flying that we do is hand flying, which can be interesting in the wet season, but you know, you get really good at your instrument scan and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, just, I don't know, I think it's not just the aeroplane, but also the operation. Like flying through the Kimberley is, again, spectacular. It's one of the things that I'd wanted to do even before I started wanting to fly floats. And then, you know, it got through instructing. And most of the time, the guys that fly through the Kimberley are a junior. They've come up north to try and build those hours. So by the time I finished up instructing, I was like, yeah, okay, I probably won't head north because there's not a great deal up there apart from maybe twins and whatever. But, you know, I could probably just as easily get them in a capital city. So I sort of resigned to the fact that I wouldn't fly through the Kimberley, and here I am now flying a 1947-built aeroplane through some of the most spectacular parts of the world and getting into even more remote parts of the Kimberley than what you would be able to in a land plane.
Yeah, very cool. Mate, it's been really cool talking to you and talking to you about your story through aviation so far. Obviously, pretty young, you're the same age as me, just about on 30 there. So still got a lot of flying left in your career. But
a long way to go.
Exactly. It's cool to hear that you've kind of chased your dream with flying floats there and now really reaping the rewards with flying one of the, I believe, and we're probably a bit biased, but one of the coolest seaplane operations in the, probably the world. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Before we go, mate, I've got this little splash and dash questionnaire. So just like a land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash, we're just going to go through a quick few little seaplane questions. You said before that you didn't have a lot of seaplane experience coming to this job. Mm-hmm. So it probably answers this one. But what would be the favourite seaplane you've ever flown?
Oh, the Cessna 185 by far.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Single pilot.
Yeah, single pilot, and I think it was also the challenge that it presented. Like, it was my first seaplane job, the one that I flew. It was this little yellow plane with these tiny little floats, and it just jumped off the water. Like, if you could get it in there, you could get it off the water, and it was great fun. It was, but, you know, very close second would be the Mallard.
I know, I'd love to get back in and do some, like, you know, piston 206, 185 type float flying, especially by yourself and stuff. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
If you have one, what would be your dream seaplane to fly?
Ooh, maybe a Catalina. I think probably a Catalina, yeah.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, that or maybe an Albatross.
You might already be in it right now, but what would be your dream seaplane job? If you could pick any seaplane job in the world, would it still be the Maldives or Happy Here or...
I think after a bit of research and reading about the Maldives, I think here has got to be the dream float job. You know, just reading about how the lifestyle over there is not quite as good as what it might be in Australia. The work-life balance here, the company, you know, all the guys that I work with, they're all, and the machine, it's just second to none.
Yeah, nice. If it wasn't seaplanes, what other aviation job would you pick, albeit another flying job or even maybe another job like ATC or management or something like that?
Oh, no, I think it would definitely be a flying job. I'd love to get into a fast jet for the Air Force, so probably that.
That'd be pretty cool, hey? And lastly, what about if you were to meet someone who was looking at maybe doing a float rating and getting into the industry, what advice would you give to any aspiring seaplane pilots out there?
Just do it. You know, the only way you're going to work out if it's something that you enjoy is by giving it a shot. You know, it's always great feeling when you've got that daily challenge and, you know, no 2 days are the same flying floats. No two landings are the same. So, yeah, I think just give it a go. Absolute worst that's ever going to happen is that you come away after doing a couple of flights in it and say, yeah, this isn't for me, but now you know. So, yeah, I think just give it a shot and take that leap of faith.
Yeah, great advice. All right, Michael, thanks very much for coming on the show and telling us your story of flying seaplanes around the world and now where you are today flying the Mallard. It was really good to chat, and once again, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
And that wraps up another show for today, folks. I'm sure you loved Michael's story just as much as I did. And don't forget to leave me a review. Like I mentioned before, 2%. Come on, guys. Let's pick that up and get a few more reviews on this show. Positive ones, of course. And get in touch to be featured on next week's Seaplane Spotlight. Now, before we go, here is a little taste of episode number 5.
We started off in Tampa and we flew all the way up. We had anywhere between 2 and 4 aircraft up in the air. And we flew from Tampa all the way up to Chicago, all the way over to Martha's Vineyard, New York area, and then back all the way down to Florida. And we probably, I think we did something insane, like a couple hundred demos. You know, we stopped in every other state. We were on the road for 3 months.
Oh, I'm really excited about this next episode, folks, talking about the Icon A5. Very exciting times ahead. But until next time, everyone, thanks very much for coming on The Step.